drinking really blocked my channel, my connection to, like, you know, higher power, whatever you want to call it, connection to self, soul, consciousness. Like, it's been unlocked now. Like, it was blocked with unawareness, self-doubt, people-pleasing, ego, and being impressive. All those things were, like, blocking me. And now that I'm free and doing my best every day to keep that channel free, that includes my creativity. Yeah, like, anything's possible.
Hi, welcome to the Growth Mixtape Podcast, and I'm your host, Bob Mathers. We have one rule here. We're going to chase our curiosity way outside our comfort zones. The more uncomfortable and awkward, the better. We're going to talk to people you've never heard of doing jobs you didn't know existed. We're going to hear human stories about the things that connect us, what we can learn from one another, and what we can take away to apply to our own lives. These conversations might not seem to have a lot in common at first, but just like songs on a mixtape, you create something memorable and emotional. Today, I talked to Michelle Hillier, a speaker, educator, and author who helps people find their authentic self by slowing down, finding their breath, and reigniting their fire. She's also a recovered alcoholic. And I never thought a conversation about addiction, recovery, and what's on the other side could be so much fun. She shares hilarious and sometimes heartbreaking stories of how drinking helped her cope, and it worked pretty good for most of her life until it didn't. She talks about how the sudden death of her father made her realize she was living in the Matrix, a life based on what society told her it should look like, and how things came to a head during the pandemic when she saw the real dark side of alcohol for the first time. This was a really powerful and personal conversation for me. I don't talk about my sobriety often, and this felt like talking to a smarter, more enlightened girl version of myself. We're all in recovery from something. Whatever yours looks like, this conversation is for you. Please enjoy Michelle Hillier. Welcome, Michelle, to the podcast. This is going to be exciting. I'm looking forward to this.
I am too. I think we have a good synergy from our first connection on the phone, and I'm pumped to see where it goes, where we take this combo.
So I'm going to tell you something, kind of a funny story, and it's super embarrassing. I can't remember your name. I have been preparing for this and reflecting on this conversation because it's something that means a lot to me. And for some reason, I keep wanting to call you Melissa. So I've got this post-it note on my computer that says, for all the listeners, I'm holding up my post-it note saying Michelle. I don't have any Melissas in my life. I have no idea where this connection between Melissa and Michelle is hardwired into my subconscious somewhere. So,
right.
I'm sure there's a list somewhere of the top 10 things you're never supposed to do as a podcaster, and calling your guests by the wrong name, I'm sure, is very near the top of that. So
it might be.
I just want to apologize in advance.
Well, you know what? I have got that in the past, Melissa and Michelle, because they were both these like longer M names. And I'm going to call you Bill when you do that.
Yeah. Fair game.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That's it. Bill and Bob.
So, yeah. One of the things that really drew me to your story, Michelle, was how open you were with kind of your experience with alcohol, addiction, and recovery. So why don't we start there? How does that journey begin with you?
Oh my goodness. It begins, well, to me, it begins with where I am now. It begins with recovery. It begins with the woman I am now. But I mean, obviously it had to get here from somewhere. So it began with seeing honestly, I know the pandemic was it hit everybody in different ways, but the pandemic was the gift to make me aware of the severity of my casual drinking, that it showed me where it could go. So that's where it began. However, if I track back in history, I've always been drawn to alcohol for fun. It was always my, go-to mechanism to connect with people, to be social. And for decades, it served me really well, I thought. Until now that I have more education on alcohol and addiction, I'm like, wow, I was a heavy drinker from the jump. If there was a party, I was there. If there was alcohol, I always had one more than all my friends. But I held everything together for decades as well. So it didn't seem, the optics of it didn't seem for me that there was a problem. Got the university, top grades. I got jobs. I did well, excelled. Alcohol worked for me until it didn't. And that's where it was my you know, coping mechanism for major life events that happened, the death of my father in 2007, which was sudden, my double hip replacement surgery after, you know, after that a couple of years later, when there was like tragedy or something that was really, that brought up, that expected me to deal with some big feelings, that's where I chose alcohol to numb them. But that's a even deeper, Bob. It's like how, this is about me dealing with my feelings and not being sort of trained or taught that as a child even. So then, you know, fast forward to the pandemic, big feelings, grief, lockdown, boredom, anxiety, and I leaned hard into what was kind of working for me for a long time. And that led to me having to surrender and choose, I had to choose sobriety. I was gonna lose so much.
That's amazing. Just for a bit of context, you've been sober 4 years. I've been sober about 2.5 years.
My first attempt at sobriety was 4 years ago, right around now. My actual sobriety date is July 21st, 2021. So I'm over 3 years.
Oh, okay. So I'm just a little bit behind you then, maybe 6 months behind you. So what do you think it was about alcohol? You talked about high school. Mm-hmm. What was it about maybe your upbringing or how you were feeling at that time that was, that alcohol felt like such a great kind of answer for what you needed?
Yeah, I've really actually thought about this. It does track back to some childhood stuff and parenting. And the role, the identity that I sort of was in high school and in younger, let's say younger adult life. So like up to 30, I consider like that's, you know, you're still figuring out who you are and your identity. And a lot of people connect alcohol with this like false courage. It gave me like the courage to talk to people in a social situation, or it gave me the courage to talk to somebody I had a crush on. That wasn't the case. I always had no problem speaking to others. That was not an issue. Where it was like, so I grew up in a house where my mom was a performer and I was put on stage at a very young age. That's how Amy and I actually know each other, is from the dance world. So I was very comfortable on stage, which like would seem that if someone's a performer, they're a natural extrovert. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the connection people assume. So I think what the alcohol helped me do was maintain this extroverted personality. So I'd arrive at a party or an event and, oh, Michelle's here, the performer's here, expected to be the performer in my personal life. And I'm actually not. In sobriety, I've really discovered this like calm, serene introvert that I never had access to. So I think, I believe the alcohol helped amp up the extrovert and kept me like the life of the party. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's so different than kind of my experience, because my experience was very much what you'd sort of alluded to, right? Like I was painfully shy and, you know, 6'2", 120 pounds, braces, glasses, you know, and so yeah, it gave me the courage to talk to girls and be funny and be the person that I sort of wanted to be. So that's interesting. That path that you described, it never really occurred to me that that would be an option. I just always assumed, I guess, that everybody's experience was similar to mine.
Yeah. And your experience is what I hear a lot. From other, you know, in the recovery circles and rooms I'm in, that is a very common story. Booze helped me it gave me a personality. It gave me the confidence. It gave me my mojo. I loved the way I felt it, or it took away, you know, discomfort and uneasiness. Alcohol made me feel calm. Mine just like, I liked it too. I liked the feeling.
Yeah.
That's why I drank. I drank for the effects of alcohol. I liked the way it felt. I liked being a little bit, you know, a little bit heightened and elevated, but it actually is a depressant. That's the funny thing about booze.
Right.
And that's where I saw the dark side of alcohol during the pandemic and during my dad's death and during like what I mentioned, those moments where my solution to like where alcohol was a fun thing for a social situation, when you use it for something where you're not feeling great and you're trying to change the way you feel, it can just take you down deeper. Right. And that was new for me.
When you talk too about your sort of your university years, it doesn't seem to have affected the kind of the performance, like the grades that you got.
Not at all.
I don't know what you call it, like functioning, I guess, high functioning.
I was high functioning for sure, but I do everything in extremes. Did everything in extremes. So, you know, third year, perfect example, I was a TA, I was a residence don, I was in, like, ran and directed the big campus-wide fashion show. I, you know, had a robust social life. I was on the Dean's Honors list that year, and I was a heavy partier. So everything was extreme, and I could hold it together then. But I think I kind of tried to keep that the extremes up. And I know we'll get to this later, but that's why I conceived Breath and Fire, because I was on fire and could access my fire, no problem, until I couldn't anymore. And I had to find my breath. I had to find the calm, the quiet, the solitude. And I never knew how to do that.
I think we would have been friends in university.
I think so. I think we would have. Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty fun. I mean, I feel like that's like 100 years ago. It was, you know, 30 years ago for me. But the memories are strong. They were great. Alcohol also gave me so many great memories. That's what's kind of messed up in this. When I have to talk about my past, and if I'm ever speaking at a meeting, like, I'm like, I had a really good time drinking. Like, so that's why the grief of it and the loss of it was part of this journey as well.
Yeah, I'd love to talk a little bit about that, because you're right. When I was going through it, there had been and these aren't ancient history stories. Like, there have been some trips that we went on even in the last kind of 4 or 5 years that were just like epic boozy affairs. But oh my God, they were, like, the truth is, I don't remember as much of it as I'd like to suggest. But oh my God, like, if you asked me my top 5 or 10 things in my life and how much fun we had with my friends, like, it was really up there.
Yeah.
So I'm like, how would that have been different? Like, yeah, I've never thought of it as grieving or mourning, but I think there was some of that, because I think, well, what future good times might I be missing out on if I'm not, you know, engaging like that?
Yeah.
Interesting.
It's true. I have had a couple, I don't socialize or do those kind of epic weekends anymore. And if they do, I do now. And a perfect example would be, like, you know, May long weekend, annual trip to Blue Mountain with a bunch of girlfriends and all their kids. I did that last year. And you know what? I'm just so absolutely blissfully happy not drinking now. But I didn't do that trip the first year because I knew that I would have some, or at least I protected myself, that I would have some sort of weird resentment, or I don't know what I was feeling. But this time, you know, I'm up early having coffee, going for a walk by myself. I'm hitting up a yoga class at the studio in town in the village in Blue Mountain, like, while they're all sleeping in. And I had go into a lot of gratitude. And I've, like, been there, done that too. I don't need to revisit those, but it's just new. Everything's new. Everything's different. And I'm at peace with it now. Like, right in early sobriety, it was tough.
Yeah.
Yeah. It takes some time.
So at what point, so you're going through university, at what point, like, when's the first time you remember thinking this thing might be getting a little out of hand?
I never thought it was a problem at all in university. No. Because I was your classic binge drinker, like, weekend party drinker. I didn't want to touch it or have the desire to touch it throughout the week unless it was associated with a social event, you know, random Tuesday night, someone's birthday at the pub. Of course I'm there. I'm always the yes girl. I would never miss it. And I wouldn't be like, oh, it's Tuesday, I've got, like, stuff to do, and it's a Tuesday. I'd be like, heck, it's a Tuesday, let's go. Like, I never missed a chance to drink. And I found people that drank like me. I would say when life got, like, real. So I worked in a cruise ship for a year after I graduated university. It was heavy drinking on that cruise ship too, but I didn't see it as a problem either, because everyone around me, all the crew and staff, were drinking like me. And I was still performing. I was a dancer on the ship, so I was still doing well at my job. I was showing up. I was performing well, and it never affected anything. And then I came back, and I had to, like, turn into an adult when I came back. And that freaked me out. I'm a bit of a Peter Pan that way, and sort of just discovered that I've ditched the Peter Pan in sobriety, but I didn't want to grow up. And when, like, life got real, and I was all of a sudden married with a job as a school teacher and living in the suburbs, and he was traveling for work, that's when I drank alone for the first time. It was out of me wanting to change the way I felt at the moment, not having the words to communicate that I wasn't happy, feeling stuck, feeling grounded, all the things that I felt during the pandemic. Actually, if I look at some similar threads, I'm like, oh, a glass of wine will help. I remember my girlfriend saying, are you drinking alone? We were on the phone together. And I said no, and thought, okay, This is weird. And then unhappiness in that relationship, not having the tools or the skills to communicate. Instead of doing that, I would want to just escape with alcohol. So, we'd be out socially, and it was a period of my life where I knew I was not, and we'll talk about this probably, I was working in the matrix, the school teaching job. Yes. So I knew I was out of alignment with my professional life as well. And that's where I probably drank heavy for about 5 years there. There's a wonderful saying, I didn't make it up. I didn't have a drinking problem. I had a life problem, and drinking was my solution. Whenever life got screwed up, that's when the drinking would ramp up.
Right.
Hey, it's Bob, and I'm taking the Growth Mixtape on the road in a series of keynote speeches inspired by the stories of my amazing guests. At their core, these signature talks are about how to get you and your teams off autopilot and stop settling for small incremental improvements. This isn't going to come from spewing business advice. My podcast is full of people that have done incredible things, and every one of them struggles with self-doubt, imposter syndrome, and the crippling fear of judgment that holds so many of us back. They've also found ways through it by rediscovering their creativity, their curiosity, and the confidence to do scary things. Imagine the power of bringing these vulnerable stories to life, live and on stage, to help you and your teams hit your targets, find your voice, and be the rock stars you are. Book me for your next event at bobmathers.ca. Now back to the show.
Yeah, I'm going to put a pin in that. Before we talk about the matrix, I've got to ask, maybe I knew this, but I forgot it. Tell me what it's like to work on a cruise ship as a dancer in your early 20s.
Amazing. I hate saying the best year of my life because my son always like, Mom, what about me?
Yeah.
Your life now. I'm like, no, it was absolute alternate reality because you're floating on this big vessel. You're not even in a real society. It's its own society. And people are from all over the world. And my only job was to dance in a show 3 times a week. That's it. And you're paying me to do this? Not like a vacation because I'm still working, but working, doing what I love doing the most in the world. And it was an amazing, I saw Hawaii, I saw all over the Caribbean, we went through the Panama Canal. It was an incredible year. I'd love my son to do that. He's not a dancer, but like work, as a host or whatever he wants to do on the ship. I think it's an incredible experience for anybody to do.
It's sort of like, is it like Dirty Dancing on water? Is it a little
bit like that? Yeah, 100%. Yes. I mastered that lift, with the other fellow dancers.
Yeah, that's crazy. I can't imagine. You're on this ship. I mean, it's very foreign to me, but I can sort of imagine what it's like. But I can tell you, in my early 20s, I can't imagine the trouble I would have gotten into with all that time on my hands on a boat.
There's
with
a lot
nothing
of free
but
time.
Booze and people to hang out with. And I got to work 3 days a week, it seems.
That's it. 3 days a week. Yeah. But this is where it's interesting. Like you'd think that if I was a real alcoholic, I'd be like seeking out booze all the time because it was accessible to us. No, I was super manageable with it. I never drank before shows and or on days we had to do things. I was a very responsible, functional drinker, but I binged like everybody else, overindulged, felt crummy the next day, pulled off a show. It felt like an extension of university with just international people and floating on the water and no studies. Well, that's nothing like university. A floating party.
I want to go to your university.
Yeah, go to my university. No school, just booze and dancing. And it was an incredible year. And I was jonesing to get back out on another one. Like I wanted to go on another contract. And that's sort of an epidemic in that world is I worked with many people that they had been out doing this, like doing cruise ships for 4, 5, 6 years. So they don't want to go back to land where it's like real shit, real reality.
Yeah.
They want to keep going out onto the ship.
Yeah. They're all hiding from something.
Uh-huh. Pretty much.
So you mentioned the Matrix. I love this concept. Tell me what your time in the Matrix was like and what it means.
Oh yeah. So that actually is perfect segue. I come back from the cruise ship. I'm lost. I'm Peter Panning my way through life. And this is when I meet the man who I connected with and got married to. And he loved this. He loved that I was this performer. It was sort of a novelty. Like he, I was doing 8 shows a week and I came back from the cruise ship and I was working professionally as a performer, like in music theater. It was fueling me and really making me happy to a point, but I knew there was something else for me. I couldn't imagine like at 60 still being on stage or something. It was like, this is what I'm doing for now. But I loved it and it was great getting paid. And then his tone changed when we got quite serious. He couldn't imagine his wife working 8 shows a week, weekends, evenings. Mish, why don't you, we'd be a great teacher, a school teacher. I never wanted to be a teacher. Like I never, this was not in my dream, but I had the skill set to be a teacher. I've always been, I'm an only child. I'm bossy. I'm a leader. Amy's eyebrows raise up. I've always been, you know, the neighborhood kid in the, on my crescent that started the club, became the director of the club, put on the show for the neighbors, told everyone where to go. Like that came naturally. And then I taught dance my whole like teenage years too for extra money. So I'm like, teacher. Yeah, I could be a teacher. So I went down to U of T, did my B.Ed, and then immediately landed a dance high school dance job. And the optics of it were like, great. I can be a teacher and live in the burbs and teach dance, not realizing that means I have to go to the same building every day, go there at the same time, being told what to do curriculum-wise, assess the kids, and I have to see the same kids every day. I don't work that way. Like that didn't. So that to me was the matrix where I had to go somewhere and do, yes, my own work when I was in the studio, the dance studio, but still someone else's work. Mm. It was a job, a J-O-B, and I felt it. After like 3 months, I'm like, I got to get out of this. You know, that, and that's kind of classic Michelle back then. I didn't want to stay in something too long. When it got boring, I wanted out. So I'm like, no, stick it out, stay. So I was in the matrix for 3 years and did my best. I got a great, what helped was I found a great social scene. So the other teachers that were young, that made it very palpable for me, was to be able to go to the building and have connections with other people. I retired early after 3 years and everyone, Bob, thought I was absolutely nuts.
Yeah, nobody does that. Nobody leaves the pension.
Leaves the pension, the benefits. And I'm not only teaching, I'm teaching dance, high school dance. Like, could it get any better?
Right.
And it could have been any worse. It was like not for me at all. Yeah, so I left to go then work down at U of T for 2 years in recruitment and events programming.
You're still in the matrix. Is that what you consider to be a matrix? Because you're sort of living somebody else's version of the life that they had envisioned for you. Yeah.
Right. The hours aren't mine. Like the time is not mine. That's a really big one as an entrepreneur now, that I know when I work best. This morning I was up at 4:30 a.m. busting out a newsletter because I was inspired laying in bed. Broop, boop, had a little nap after. We'll do some more work later after this conversation. That is how I need to operate to function at the peak for me.
So what happened then? How did you find your way out of the matrix?
Well, tragically, unfortunately, my dad had a sudden heart attack. So while in the matrix, I still found ways to fuel my passions. So I taught at Bally's Fitness downtown. So I was teaching a class at lunch hour. I think it was a kickboxing class or something, to like break up my matrix day. I have to go down and be around people and move and sweat and laugh and hear music. And I was coming back to the office and everyone swarmed me. Your dad, his heart, the hospital called, your mom called, Dave called, like everybody's calling. And he had passed while I was teaching. He had a sudden heart attack. So I zipped my way down to Waterloo, where I was from, and didn't get a chance to see him. But that's when my life changed instantly, because I'm an only child. So I had to be there for my mom. I stayed. I took a leave from the university to stay with my mom and sort of do all of that, which I can also layer on top, Bob. That's when booze played a role too. Like alcohol really showed up when I had to deal with something very emotional and very out of this sorts for my mom and I to be in a vulnerable space together emotionally. We didn't grow up that way. So I was very uncomfortable grieving with her. So I would drink and just like, you know, a nice buzz all the time that would kind of just get me functionally through things. And from there, I remember having a dawning moment. I was in my childhood bed and I was lying there and I thought, okay, when this is all wraps up, I'm going back to the university. I can't, I can't. And my dad's voice was sort of there, and he always instilled in me that I could honestly do anything, like absolutely believed in me. And so did my mom, but my dad especially had a special part for me in there. And he would want me to do what I want to do and try it and go for it, give it a go. And you can't fail if you give it a go, and, you know, always believed in me. So I'm like, I'm going to quit and start my own business. I've got connections in the education system. The new dance curriculum had just come out in Ontario. Nobody was doing teacher personal professional development. I'm creative. I can do this. I started spinning and I started writing and mind mapping. And that was the conception of my company then. And that was 17 years ago. So I incorporated, he died in May, and I incorporated my business in August, 4 months later.
It's amazing how we need something tragic to wake us up to other opportunities, or for us to just give us a little bit of time to breathe and reflect and look back and say, wow. Because I'm sure I'd like to think you would have eventually found your way to starting that business. But how much longer, like, what do you think would have happened if your dad hadn't have passed away so tragically? How much longer would you have lived in the matrix before something maybe would have pulled you out of it?
You know what? I don't even know. I don't even know. I can't, I probably a year maybe I would have given it, or I don't even know. And the same, I think, what if the pandemic didn't happen?
Right.
Would I be sober and divorced? No, I think I'd still be drinking and married. And those are like two tragic big things that happened in my life. I'd say the two biggest.
Yeah.
And two massive outcomes came from that, professionally and personally.
So between those two things, your dad passing away, you start your business, and then COVID, there's a few good years in there, right? 10 years.
There are. There's motherhood.
Okay.
Become a mother. That's another big one.
Yeah. Let's not brush over that. So
let's not brush over motherhood.
But again, you're managing, you've started your business, you're out of the matrix, you're an entrepreneur.
Loving it.
You're still managing, drinking, you're still functioning.
You know what? I want to say probably less. I was really motivated by starting my business and really inspired and happy, and felt like my authentic self. And that's a piece I talk about in my recovery now, is like authenticity is one of my core values. I did a core values test a couple months ago. It was a speed round one, like where you look at 100 words, down to 12, down to 8, down to 4, down to 2. My two are authenticity and health. Those are my two core values, and they drive every decision I make, and they make sense. When I'm not doing something authentically, that's when the alcohol ramped up my whole life.
So it's interesting. You can look back on your life having done that that core values test, and it helps provide a lens. Like, you see these peaks of your drinking over your life and be like, oh yeah, there's something off about authenticity or health, which
that's right,
explains everything when I look at it through that lens and my core values. That's interesting. I'd like to know more about that core values test. Maybe you could
send us
a link, and we'll put it in the show notes, because I don't think, it's something that I revisit every, 6 months or 12 months. Usually it's because, hey, maybe I should look at my website. Oh yeah, let's revisit the values and everything.
Right. It's
probably a much better reason to do it.
I hadn't done one of those in a while. And actually I teach at the University in Oshawa, and I wrote an elective called Teacher Wellness. So I teach that out there on Thursday nights. And it has been amazing for me discovering, because I'm writing the curriculum for it as I go. And that's what I had my class do. So I did it with them, but also doing all like the Enneagram, the Myers-Briggs, the Human Design. I'm doing this all now in like my life now, which is my authentic, fully life. I've done them all before, but now answering them and seeing myself now, it's extremely interesting. But I loved how you said you can look back. I'd never done that, Bob, because now I think like, oh, it drives my decisions moving forward, obviously. But if I look back, when I was out of alignment with health and integrity, that is when I chose to turn to change the way I feel with alcohol.
Right.
Yeah.
So tell me, you've talked a little bit about COVID as a gift, which isn't something I hear often.
Oh,
can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, that forced me to see where alcohol could go for me. The relationship I had with alcohol and how extreme it could go, and it probably could have gone further if I didn't get myself out of my situation. I went to a treatment center for 30 days in November of 2020. My husband and friends really circled around me and said, like, you can't do this here at home in the lockdown with my son at the time was eight. And my husband was writing his PhD. It was a lot of pressure. And it was the pandemic. It was like, and all my work was gone.
Yeah.
So a lot of my purpose, I had 2020 quite booked with speaking engagements and workshops and gigs, traveling, all the things I love, canceled. So I was home sort of purposeless and finding my way with pivoting, doing things online, but not having the connection with humans that I love with the work I do. It's when I saw the dark side of alcohol, which I never had in my whole career drinking. So my husband and I thought, it was more his decision. we're drinking too much. Let's quit. Let's just like cut it out in July of 2020. And I thought, no, I don't know how to, I don't want to do that. And I don't know how I'm going to do that because it's my complete coping mechanism to deal with life right now and everything going on. So that's what I mean by dark side. It's when it got to be like the sneaking, the lying, the hiding, the weird stuff that you see that I would see characters in movies doing, and I was doing it, like putting the wine in the mailbox and saying I'm going for a walk and going to the wine store, like, but very aware as I'm doing it and very troubled and very lost and very helpless and helpless and hopeless, really dark.
So you went to treatment the first time, but you said earlier that is that the time that didn't quite stick?
Yes. Yeah. So I went for 30 days, came out and was sober for 7 months. I was doing all like nature walks and journaling and meditating and not really connecting with anybody else. I was sort of keeping private and just not drinking and trying to fill my day with all these holistic practices. Mm. But I didn't surrender to the fact that I really was an alcoholic, that I really had a problem, which kept me, and I didn't work a program. So I thought, AA was presented to me as an option. And I thought, I'm too good for that. I'll make my own program up. Like that's my ego was like fully present when I came out of treatment, that I could just do it on my own. I've got this, all those things that are very dangerous to say when you're trying to get sober for good. So after 7 months, I thought, I can drink like a normal person again. I'll just try it. And it just was the same. It went right back to 5 weeks of sort of drinking and, sneaking it, lying about it. And then I fully surrendered in July of 2021 and tried AA and got a good therapist and got a sponsor, went to meetings, worked the steps. But the real deal was I got to the root of why I was drinking. Like that's when I started doing all these things I talked about, looking at my past, looking at patterns, diving into my character as a person and why I chose to cover up parts of my life with alcohol. So I just got really real with myself 3 years ago and uncovering that stuff and getting more information and getting to know myself better and showed me the way I want to live and how it's possible. I don't have any desire to touch alcohol anymore.
Yeah, I've often thought about that because I've never done a program, but I just imagine that experience that you described, Michelle. It's like soon as you even think that you might have it licked, like you think, you know what, I think I've grown. I think I've got this. I could probably, like as soon as it even enters your brain that you could have a drink, you're done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was my, I'm like, I'm good. I've gone like 7 months.
Right.
I think I can do this again. I don't do really anymore, but I used to romanticize, about a glass of wine with my dinner. And then I have to do like a wake up call being like, you never had a glass of wine with dinner.
What's the point of having one glass of wine?
It was one glass of dinner. I was at a women's retreat a couple weekends ago with 150 women up at a camp, and I was teaching up there. And it was a bit of a boozy night. And I looked around, and I'm very like self-talk and self-aware. I look around going, you know, everyone's having a drink. Do I want one? Of course not. I don't. Like, this is all like my little narrative. No, of course I don't want one. I'm good. I've got a bubbly. Yeah, I look around. What would it be like to have a glass of wine? What would it feel like? And then I'm like, Michelle, you never just had a glass of wine. You would have had a bottle with the girls in the cabin before you came down for dinner. You would have polished off two more bottles. You would have been deadly hungover tomorrow. Like, I play the tape forward.
Yes.
It's going to happen. And then I go, oh, this bubbly looks amazing. And it's gone. It's feeling gone. But those thoughts are always going to come in. Like, my natural default social girl in me, of course, I'm going to have that little conversation with myself as I enter a room of women drinking, having a good time, laughing. And I've got a sparkling water.
Yeah, man, that's true. I love this idea of kind of living authentically. So I wonder what the connection is between that. I want to bring it to your breath and fire work because it's really interesting. I don't know whether the breath and fire, is this something you came up with? Is this something that's a way of thinking about being authentic or creative or what? Like, I don't, walk me through what that means to you.
Sure. Yeah. I was, so my business platform before was very heavily focused on movement. So it was called Experience Groove. That was my company. And prior to that, it was Fit to Dance. So it was very much about the movement, physical fitness side of life and the slowing down, meditation, breath work, yoga side of my life was never really explored. It was more about the high energy side of my life. And in sobriety and recovery, I started moving my body differently. And after my double hip replacement, I was forced to move my body differently from 2018 onwards. So that was huge for me. So slowing down physically and then dabbling with and loving meditation, getting trained to be a meditation teacher, breath work. I'm now a breath work teacher as well. So all these, and yoga, I got my yoga 200-hour training. So all these new parts of my life in the last 3 years were so different from the way I was living and moving my body for like 30 years. And I started journaling one morning. I was trying to figure out, like, my name can't be Experience Groove anymore. It's very old brand, high energy. It just had a vibe I was looking to change as I was rebranding my platform. And I got into like thinking about the elements and fire, you know, earth, water. And breath just came up as a way, because I feel like I can breathe now in sobriety and recovery, and I have the space to catch my breath, and that's in many ways. And then the fire is like the passion, everyone has that fire. So that breath and fire, this is like the two, the yin, the yang, the balance, the positive, negative, the masculine, feminine, it's the opposites. And if I can achieve those every day, like always remember to find my breath and ignite my fire. And that's what I end up calling my platform. It's a platform for all the work I do, which is coaching, speaking, and educating. So everything I do involves the breath and the fire, whether it be in workshop content, content creation, speaking engagements. I talk about that in all the classes that I teach. It's not just move, move, move. We're going to breathe. We're going to slow down, and we're going to explore the breath and the fire.
Yeah. Tell me about this slowing down. If I think about my life, I spend a lot of time on the fire side. Like, I do a lot of exercising and I'm super active. I do sort of like this idea of slowing down though. How did you, I know you had a double hip replacement, it was sort of forced you to slow down, but what does slowing down mean?
I still can move vigorously, but it's a choices I'm making now to slow down. And it's, you know, so I put so many steps on my feet in early sobriety. I easily 20,000 steps a day in my first couple months of sobriety. I just would get out for a walk when I felt stuck or didn't know what to do with myself, you know, swirling my tie. Like, what do I do with myself now? Witchy now, or I would get hit the pavement. So walking was a huge slowdown for me. And then I think, Bob, it comes with like being in tune, like being tuned in to the way I'm feeling as I'm moving my body and really honoring it. I would just go. I was like the hottest CrossFit class, teaching boot camp classes, harder, faster, extremes. Like, I would just work in the extremes. I don't know if I was running away or escaping something or trying to be impressive. That's a huge piece I've investigated in my sobriety too, is this need to be impressive my whole life, which had me do these extremes. in all ways. Party too hard, workout too hard. So the slowing down part, I developed in early sobriety when I was home, the lockdown was on. I developed my own morning little flow routine. I actually started doing it when I was in the treatment center. We were in a great room. I was up in Muskoka, a place called Greenstone. And we had a nice fireplace in my room and lots of carpeted area. So I started laying out my yoga mat, listening to music and moving my body intuitively, not to impress anybody, not because I'm teaching anybody, No one's watching, but moving it for me. And that was brand new. And that morning little flow developed into something that I teach now. That's what the breath and fire experience is, like the actual class is that was birthed out of my morning flow at the treatment center. I feel the best physically that I've ever felt. And I feel like I'm moving my body slower. It's blowing my mind.
There's so much I love about that idea. One of the things that I've found since I've been sober is that I do feel this sort of compulsion to make up for lost time. And so there's a bunch of things I want to do. I want to read a book. I want to, you know, run this far. I do a lot of walking. And I have a hard time sitting still because I feel guilty. Like I know I pissed away 35 weekends of 35 years. I got a lot of things to do and I want to be, and I want to believe that I'm more present and there with the people that I'm around, but I have a really hard time slowing down.
I did too. I for sure did. Like my friends that have known me forever cannot believe how I love solitude now. I didn't want to be alone.
Right.
This is the first time I've lived alone in my life. That's wild. I'm turning 50 in a month. I'm living alone for the first time. What? I went from roommates to cruise ships, to boyfriends, to husbands, boom, boom, boom. I never lived alone.
What would the Matrix say about that? The Matrix would say, what are you? Yeah. You're an outcast. You're not allowed to be living at home alone when you're 50.
I know, home alone. I also don't give two shits what anyone thinks anymore. So right. Here I am, like living alone, figuring out life again, kind of rebuilding, restarting. I find it invigorating. I love it because I feel good. I feel really, really good. I have a lot of hope. And I'm leaning into aging really well. I don't think I would have been. I feel better turning 50 than I was turning 40. My son was 2 and I was a little bit heavier, but I was drinking a ton and I was moving my body a ton. It was in extremes. My business was at its height, but it wasn't manageable. Like step one of the 12-step program is life is unmanageable. I'm powerless over alcohol. Yes. And life is unmanageable. My life was unmanageable for so, so long. So the slowing down is this way of life my girlfriends find fascinating that I enjoy it so much. I nap every day. I call it giving my nervous system a rest.
Yeah.
And it really, really works. It's being tuned into myself. I wasn't tuned in.
One last thing I wanted to ask you about, what's happened to your creativity through this process?
Ooh, good question. So my creativity flourishes, like it manifests itself in the most when it comes to music and moving my body. My creativity around that has absolutely expanded, I would say. And my creativity in terms of what's possible, my creative problem solving has very much so taken off, and hope for like what creative ideas I have for the future. And I feel like I'm always creating, even having a child, parenting, like constantly coming up with creative solutions for him. Yep. Like thinking on your feet, you're always creative. I see creativity sort of everywhere.
Yeah.
And I would just say I have more access to it. Like it's just available. Drinking really blocked my channel, my connection to higher power, whatever you want to call it, connection to self, soul, consciousness. It's been unlocked now. Like it was blocked with unawareness, self-doubt, people pleasing, ego, and being impressive. All those things were like blocking me. And now that I'm free and doing my best every day to keep that channel free, that includes my creativity. Yeah. Like anything's possible.
Do you think your friends are looking at you and your life thinking, maybe Michelle's onto something here? Or not quite? Are you still? Because I'm the only one. All my friends still drink. That's totally fine. I'm totally happy with that. But I'm wondering if you feel like you've at least shown them a different way. Cause it's, for me, it's like the last thing, I'm not judging. I mean, I did this. I was at the front of the pack for years. Maybe they decide to do this one day. Maybe they never do. That's totally up to them. I'm not judging, but God damn, it's just, life is just so much better.
Well, it's funny you ask that, Bob. I'm like, think as you're asking me that, the people that are closest, so my 50th coming up, I'm like, I've identified these like 8 women that have helped me get to 50. Like they've been in my life for sometimes some short, some longer. I've made some beautiful connections to women in recovery. And that was something I kind of, when I first got sober, I'm like, I don't want new friends. I don't need new friends. I don't want to connect with anybody. But that was connected to me not admitting that I really had a problem where I had to get another friend that was sober. Sounds awful. She is one of my closest people in my life right now. And will be, because we get each other on a whole different level. She's also sober. And she's also, this is the funny part, she's also like 15 years older than me. It doesn't matter. Like we just connect. Yeah. So if I were to look at those 8 women, I partied with all of them, but their relationship with alcohol has changed a bit too. I don't know if it's just our age and perimenopause and menopause connections. It's not working well for them in their life anymore. They definitely look at me and know I'm onto something. They probably keep a little bit of their drinking experiences from me as well. They don't share if they've had a wild weekend at a son's hockey tournament.
Yeah.
Woo-hoo! They don't share as much with me, but our relationships have gotten closer for sure. They've gotten deeper. They've gotten much deeper. But yeah, they do. I do believe that they think I'm onto something.
Yeah, I found that too. I was just like, you know, nobody's, now we're, like you said, we're getting older. I'm like, so one of two things has happened. Either you're getting, none of you are drinking as much because I'm around, or I was just the one getting hammered all the time. And you were just, you were never really drinking that much because this is lame. Exactly, I thought I was going to watch you guys get loaded and stumble around and like I was going to be entertained, and you guys are boring.
I had the exact same thing. I'm like, wow, you don't really stay up late anymore, and no one busts out the big sound system. I'm like, that was you were the one that opened another bottle. You cranked up the sound system. You did this. I'm like, oh my god, I bullied my friends to drink like this.
Yes. Oh my god, that's so true.
So true.
I could talk about this forever, Michelle. It's something that's just so personal and near and dear to my heart. What are you most excited about now? What's next?
Ooh, what's next? How I'm going to contribute, like my service to the world. What is next for me? It's funny. Like, here I am 50. What will I be when I grow up? Is kind of the question. I feel like I'm at a precipice right now. I spent the last 3 years really getting to know myself and knowing who I am deeply, what I love, what I don't, like really diving in deep on the personal side. And I'm at the point now where my recovery feels very solid. My thing is not today. If someone asks me, are you going to drink anymore? I'm like, not today. So I don't know what the future brings. But on a giving back, being a service to the world, I'm looking now at like my experiences, my skill sets, my qualifications, my wisdom, I guess you can say, how can these all bundle together to create something to put out to the world? And I know Breath and Fire needed to be conceived as that name 2 years ago, but now I want to really lean into it in 2025. What does that mean for me? So that's what I'm most excited about, is seeing what I create to give back to the world. Take my mess and make it my message and monetize it. There you go. Because we all need to eat. Like I'd love to be of service and like offer everything for free. Love it. But I got to, you know, I have to live in Toronto in this insane real estate market. But I need, how can I take all the messy stuff I've been through and have someone not have to go through it?
Yeah, that really resonates. I love that. You know, all of this must have been for a reason. So the thing that makes you uniquely you is this oddball collection of tragedies and experiences and fuck ups. How can you take this, all this raw material, and craft it into something that, yes, is of service to others, but also, yeah, pays the bills.
Pays the bills. And I'm doing that now in so many beautiful ways. I work back full circle. I work at the treatment center that I went to as a mind body visiting professional. I go, and I'm a recovery coach too. So I have a coaching program for women. I mostly work with women that are on that journey. If they're sober curious, or if they're sober and need just help living in recovery, and it's got embodiment practices, because I think this is ignored a lot, the body in recovery. Like, unbelievable. If that woman that was there 4 years ago could have like been told, in 4 years, you're going to be working here because you're going to be so into recovery and believe in it so hard. And meanwhile, I didn't want to even give up booze 4 years ago. It's mind blowing.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it is.
This has been so amazing, Michelle. I know I'm going to be reflecting on this conversation. There's so much there. I'm feeling pretty good about myself for not calling you Melissa. So that's, yay! I'm going to take that away. I can't thank you enough. I really like to do this again.
Yes, absolutely. I think we just scratched the surface. And thanks for getting me to go there with some really great prompts. That was, it was total joy talking to you, Bill.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Love it.
The Growth Mixtape Podcast with Bob Mathers is produced by Bespoke Projects. Music by Je M'appelle Walter Cronkite. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to follow and rate us. When you do this, it helps to raise our podcast profile so that more people can find us. If you want to connect, you can find me on LinkedIn using the link in the show notes.